Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Catalyst. My name is JR. I'm the teaching pastor here, and this is my new friend, Sydney. Sydney is our guest worship director today. Nathan is on vacation in Maine, I think, is what I heard. Okay, spread that rumor either way. I think he's in Portland, Maine. So we're very grateful to have Sydney with us. You'll be hearing lots more from her here in a few minutes. But I wanted to begin this morning by telling you a story about a time that a good friend of mine told me that she probably wasn't going to be able to continue coming to church anymore. It was back when I was a youth pastor, first church where I was working, and like I said, this woman was a good friend of mine. She was a volunteer in our youth group. Her son was one of our teens. They were great, loved them a lot, and she came up to me one Sunday after worship, and she said, "JR, I just don't know if I can continue to be a part of this church." And of course, immediately I was like, very devastated because she was great. Her, like I said, her kid was part of our youth group and everything. So I asked her why, and she said, "Well, our pastor talks a lot about family and how important family is. But I know that when he talks about family, he's not talking about me and my son. Because I'm a single mom, because my son is mixed race." And I wished in that moment that I could have told her that she was wrong, but I couldn't. I was single at the time. I didn't get married for probably another 2 or 3 years after this moment took place. And I felt the same kind of a thing. I had been set up on one blind date by one of the sweet little old ladies at our church, and it went so horrifically badly that I think word spread through the church, like, not to set me up with anyone. But they were constantly trying to, like, wheel and deal and figure out how to, you know, how to get me married. I was told multiple times that that was what I needed to fix me. Guess it didn't work, but whatever. I say all that to say, when she told me that she knew that when our church talked about family, it didn't include her family. I knew that she was right. I knew that when our church talked about families, they were talking about the so-called traditional family, like what we see in Leave It to Beaver, right? Mom, dad, 2.5 kids, dog optional, right? And she didn't look like that. Her family didn't look like that. My family didn't look like that. So that church at the time, they were a really good church for families like the Cleavers. They were not a very good church for people who didn't look like that, for families that didn't look like that. And I think that's, in hindsight, I think that's really strange because, Jesus never got married. Paul, who wrote about a quarter of the New Testament, never got married and was actually pretty negative about marriage. We sort of skip over Paul's words about marriage, but he was pretty down on marriage overall. And the what we call the traditional family, like, you know, the Cleavers, that didn't even exist until like the 1950s. So you can't find, for instance, anywhere in the Bible a family that looks like what we think of when we talk about family. And yet, despite these facts, churches all over the country sort of enshrine the traditional family, what we call often the nuclear family, as the ideal, as the gold standard for what God desires for us. And so we're going to see today that that's not the case, that actually God's design for family is something radically different from that. In God's reality, family means a spiritual family. And the spiritual family, the church, has enough room for people of all different kinds, of families that look all kinds of different ways. And that's actually good news. That's good news for all of us who have families that don't look like the Leave It to Beaver family. And it's good news for everyone who has a super healthy, functional, flourishing family. God's vision for family is one that creates a space for all of our families to be able to flourish and to grow together. So I want to hand it over to Sydney and to the worship team, and they're going to begin leading us in worship this morning. If you're a guest with us, I want to say welcome. We're so happy that you are here, and we hope that during the gathering today you feel welcomed and encouraged and challenged. At the end of the gathering, we're going to be receiving communion together, and so if you're here in person, hopefully you got one of the little communion cups on the way in that has the elements. If you're at home, please make sure you gather some elements so that you can be ready to receive communion with us in a little bit. Now, if you would all stand, I want to pass it over to the worship team for us to begin singing together. We are in the middle of Lent right now, which is the season in the church that we set aside for confession, for repentance. It's our way of responding to the God that we met during Epiphany and preparing ourselves to journey with Jesus to the cross and to the victory of the resurrection on the other side of Easter. So this year, our Lenten series is called God Is Not. And we're basing it around a, if you want the $20 word, which, you know, I always think is fun, if you want to press your friends later, right? It's called apophatic theology. It's a theology of emptiness or a theology of nothingness. And it actually goes way back, but one of the most famous theologians to sort of chart this out was named Thomas Aquinas. And I want to read this quote for you and then kind of break down how it's shaping our Lenten series. So Aquinas says, "We cannot know what God is, only what God is not. We must therefore consider the ways in which God does not exist rather than the ways in which God does." So Thomas Aquinas is saying, because God is infinite, right? Because God is beyond us, because we are creatures and God is the creator, we cannot know fully who God is. Other theologians have said every time we try to put words to God or to label God or to describe God, we're actually creating idols because those words always fall short of who God truly is. So Aquinas and others have said, so instead of trying to tell who God is, what if we sort of do the opposite? It's like that story about Michelangelo carving the David. When someone asked how he did that, he said, well, you know, I just looked at a brick of marble and I cut away everything that didn't look like David. And then what was left was David, which, you know, I guess if you're a genius sculptor, makes sense. To me, it just seems really intimidating, right? But that's sort of what apophatic theology does. It says, instead of trying to label God, what if we just pull away all of the things that we know God is not, so that that helps us know the divine mystery that is God in a more whole way? So during this series, we've been doing exactly that. We've been taking some of the ways that our culture, even our church culture, has tried to label God. We've been saying, well, yeah, but God's not that. That's actually an idol that we've created. So we began by saying that God is not you, right? God is not me. We often try to set ourselves up in the place of God and assume that God agrees with us and is on our side and fights our battles. And we rejected that. We said, no, we have to understand that we are creatures and that God is the creator. And understanding that relationship rightly is an important first step in knowing God more fully. Then we talked about how God is not a capitalist, and we looked at the abundance that comes from knowing God and loving God, and how that argues against the culture of scarcity and lack that we all live in. Last week, then, Sonia talked with us about reparations, and we talked about how God takes what happened in the past seriously. God is not a God who ignores injustice and ignores the cries of the oppressed, but takes those seriously and calls us to be a part of healing those ancient wounds. So today, we're talking about another really, I think, maybe the most challenging idol that we're going to encounter in this series, which is the idea that what we're saying today is that God is not a family man. And there may not be a value in American culture that is more core to our own self-conception than the idea of family and how important family is to us. If you want proof of that, think about, I know it's like an election year again, and it feels like we just survived one of those. At least it's like an off-election year, but if you're anything like our household, you're already getting tons of political flyers in the mail for all these different candidates. And think about what's on the flyer, right? On one side, you have the candidate, maybe their slogan or whatever, but often if you open it up or you flip it over, what is there? There's a picture of them and their family, right? Because they want to be known as a person with a healthy family, because that's so core to who we are as Americans. And oftentimes that family looks like a nuclear family, right? Like the Leave It to Beaver family. You've got the candidate and their partner, their spouse, and then their couple of kids all smiling in suits and dresses and whatever. When we say family in American culture, what we mean is that nuclear family. And again, that's weird because the vast majority of families in America don't look like a nuclear family, but we still cling on to that. That actually goes back to around the 1950s. There was a lot happening all at once in that period of American culture. We had the post-World War II economic boom. We had cities that had become the central point, the focal point of American culture that were giving rise to suburbs. So you had a bunch of single-family housing being built all over the country. You had the advent of television. Right, so then that's when you had shows like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and all of these kind of shows that sort of enshrined the family. And then you had the atomic age, right? We had finally cracked the atom. And so this was now like all anyone was talking about. Everything was going to be futuristic and there were going to be robots and stuff like that. But we called it the atomic age because the atom at the time was understood to be the smallest unit of matter. That if you just kept breaking things into their component parts, eventually you got to an atom, and you couldn't divide it any further than an atom. So we thought, turns out we were wrong about that, and there's like quarks and gluons and mesons and all kinds of ons, right? We know that now, but back then, everyone thought the atom was the core, indivisible unit of matter. And so we called the family, mom, dad, kids, the nuclear family, because we imagine them to be the nucleus of an atom. We imagine the family, that specific nuclear family, to be the smallest, most indivisible unit of Americana, right? And it was like mom, dad, kids, bald eagle, like boom, that was it. That was like America in a nutshell. Now, again, that's interesting because even then, and especially today, most families don't look like a nuclear family. Maybe like me, you come from a blended family, right? My parents are divorced, both of them are remarried, so I have step-siblings and step-grandparents, and I had step-step-grandparents, like my step-parents, step-parents, you know, I had, and so my family tree is more like a family orchard, I guess. I don't really know, right? But like, that's what my family looks like. And if you want to know my family, it's not a nuclear family. It's this big kind of messy, fun, like amalgam of stuff. Maybe your family is what a lot of scholars call a three-generation family, where instead of in one household you have parents and kids, you have maybe a grandparent that lives with you, or an aunt, or a sibling, or some adult sibling. You have this more extended kind of a family, which actually looks a lot more like the families that were in the Bible times, right? You didn't have a household that just had two parents and two kids. Like, you had all these generations of family all living in one roof, and that roof was a lot bigger because there were a lot more people. We still have a lot of that today. We have people who live with, tias and tios and cousins and siblings and all this kind of stuff under one roof. And that's just what family looks like for a lot of us. So to narrowly define family as this nuclear family that we saw enshrined on television with, the cleavers and all of that, it's strange. And yet we did that. And we did that to the point that, like, the family that I shared at the beginning will say, I don't feel like my family counts as a real family, because it doesn't look like the cleavers. And churches adopted that kind of wholesale. Again, in that same church where that exchange happened, I was in a meeting where one of the pastoral staff said, God created the family before God created the church, which means that the family is more primary than the church. And I was like, I think that's actually the literal definition of idolatry when you put anyone above God. But, okay, whatever, that's me, right? We have adopted this wholesale. We have taught people that what God wants for you is this very narrow definition of family that again, most of us have never experienced. So what I want to do today is look at a couple of families in the scriptures, one from the Old Testament, I want to look at Jesus's family. And I want to look at how God challenges the primacy of family in our lives. And again, I know that this can be sensitive for us, because we all have all kinds of different families. For some of us, families are sources of great joy and belonging. They make us feel stable and secure. For a lot of us, it's the opposite. Families are a place of pain and anxiety. They maybe aggravate a lot of our feelings of unworthiness or conflict. And then I think there's another big group of us that's kind of both of those, right? We have this like love-hate relationship with our family, because it's both and it's just complicated. And so what I want to do is take that with us into the scriptures and look at God's call on our families. So if you have a Bible, go ahead and turn with me to Genesis chapter 31. This is early in the scriptures. This is in the story of Jacob. Jacob's family, by the way, in the running, and it's a packed field, but in the running for most dysfunctional family in the Bible. When Jacob was born, he was a twin, and he and his brother were, their parents played favorites. So Jacob's brother Esau was his dad's favorite, Jacob was his mama's favorite, and they weren't subtle about it, okay? You don't have to like read between the lines. It's like in the text, right? So as you can imagine, that created all kinds of conflict as they grew up. At one point, Jacob betrays his brother and steals his birthright, and then it causes his brother to get a little murdery, and so Jacob has to flee. So his mom sends him to live with his uncle, Laban, who we're going to meet in the story. Now, while Jacob is living with Laban, he meets Laban's daughter, Rachel, who is apparently quite the looker. He falls head over heels, and he goes to his uncle and says, what will it take for me to be able to marry your daughter? I don't have a dowry, right? I'm on the run for my life, whatever. Laban says, no problem. Work for me for 7 years, and I'll let you marry my daughter. And if you're thinking, wait, isn't his uncle's daughter his cousin? Isn't that gross? Yeah, sorry. Like, it's just in, it was a thing. Okay, that's... incest is bad, but not part of the story, right? So it's different sermon. So So Jacob works for 7 years. Time comes for him to marry, and he gets tricked into marrying Rachel's older daughter, Leah. He's angry about this. He goes to his uncle, and his uncle makes up a bunch of excuses and says, tell you what, if you still really want to be with Rachel, then you can work for 7 more years, and then you can marry her. So he does that. He works for 7 more years. Now he has married both sisters. Between his two wives and their two slaves, he ends up having a whole bunch of children, 12 sons plus some more. And Jacob is he's a really good, what we would today call a really good businessman, right? He's really good with the flocks. He's really good at managing people. And so under his care, Laban's, his uncle's property, just he gets really, really, really wealthy. And it gets to the point where there's too much. And when we say too much, we're talking in terms of animals, right? They just can't sustain all of the flocks that they have. And Jacob's people and Laban's people are getting into fights over the best areas, you know, the best areas. So Laban, or Jacob says to Laban, you know, I think we need to part ways. Laban recognizes that Jacob is that goose laying that golden egg, and he doesn't want to let him go. So he basically doesn't let him, right? That's the short version. We're fast forwarding, by the way, obviously through a bunch of dysfunction over several chapters to get to where we are. All this culminates in Jacob essentially tricking Laban, packing up his wives and his kids and all of his flocks and ducking out before Laban has a chance to figure out what's going on. Okay, so Jacob lights out, big caravan full of people on the run. Obviously a big caravan doesn't get to move that fast, and it's not real subtle, so you know they're just kind of slowly getting their way out. Laban eventually does get word of what's happening, and he chases Jacob down. And that's the interaction that we're going to be looking at today, is this final kind of big confrontation between Jacob and Laban that comes at the end of decades at this point of swindling, backstabbing, cheating each other, all in the name of family, right? So with all of that in mind, let's go to verse 25. Laban caught up with Jacob as he was camped in the hill country of Gilead. And he set up his camp not far from Jacob's. Laban demanded, what do you mean by deceiving me like this, right? By tricking me and lighting out and taking everything. How dare you drag my daughters away like prisoners of war? Why did you slip away secretly? Why did you deceive me? And why didn't you say you wanted to leave? Jacob did say that he wanted to leave, right? I would have given you a farewell feast with singing and music accompanied by tambourines and harps. Now, if you're thinking the lady doth protest too much, you're right. Right? Laban is lying here, right? Jacob had asked to leave at different points. He had tried to get away. Laban had never let him. Laban had no intention of letting Jacob get away because their long history together was the history of two foxes trying to outcon each other. And sometimes Laban would get the upper hand, sometimes Jacob would get the upper hand, but they were constantly engaged in this battle of who can cheat the other one out of the most stuff. And again, I think most of us, if we have not experienced this directly in our families, we've probably at least been near to it. Either a spouse or a close friend has had these kind of family issues, right? Where there's someone that you feel like you have to walk on eggshells around all the time, or there's just like this one fight that you keep coming back to over and over and over. We've talked in here before about how groups of people, whether that's, you know, work groups or family groups or church small groups or whatever, when there's conflict that goes unresolved, you go into this cycle where you just kind of blow up into conflict and you tamp it back down and you go back to that like superficial peace, and then it kind of just keeps in this cycle over and over because you never do anything different, and eventually you reach burnout. Well, that's what happened, right? Jacob reached burnout. He was like, we just can't do this. We got to do something different. And something different meant leaving, right? So Jacob left. He said, I just can't do this anymore. And when Laban catches up, Laban recognizes ultimately, either he recognizes that Jacob is right, that they just can't keep staying locked in the same cycle, or he realizes he can't really stop Jacob from leaving, right? So ultimately, if we skip down a few verses, we see that Laban acknowledges that Jacob's going to leave, and they actually are going to basically formalize it. So watch this. Then Laban replied to Jacob, these women are my daughters, and these children are my grandchildren, and these flocks are my flocks. In fact, everything you see is mine. But what can I do now about my daughters and their children? So come, Let's make a covenant, you and I, and it will be a witness to our commitment. So Jacob took a stone, set it up as a monument. And then he said to his family members, gather some stones. So they gathered stones and piled them in a heap. And then Jacob and Laban sat down beside the pile of stones to eat a covenant meal. To commemorate the event, Laban called the place Jagar Sahadutha, which means witness pile in Aramaic, and Jacob called it Galeed, which means witness pile in Hebrew. Then Laban declared, this pile of stones will stand as a witness to remind us of the covenant we have made today. This explains why it was called Galeed, or witness pile. But it was also called Mitzpah, which means watchtower, for Laban said, may the Lord keep watch between us to make sure that we keep this covenant when we are out of each other's sight. If you mistreat my daughters or marry other wives, God will see to it, even if no one else does. He is a witness to this covenant between us. Okay, so you can hear the formal language, right? But the you know, the piling up of the rocks, the eating a meal together, those are things that we don't typically do in our culture in this formal way. So let me be really, really clear about what's happening here. Jacob and Laban are doing a formal recognition that they are breaking community together. This is basically what we would today call a formal divorce, right? This is them signing a legal contract that says we now no longer have any tie, any obligation to each other. Okay, they're drawing a literal boundary here and marking it. I think that's really interesting that they recognize that their relationship has been so toxic that it's actually wounding both of them, and that the best thing that they can do is to part ways. In fact, for Jacob, if he is to be faithful to the God of his father, right, of Abraham and Isaac and, you know, Jacob, if he is to be faithful to God and to God's call, he has to leave Laban. He has to go back to his father's country. And so there's this formalized boundary marker that's set in place that says we have to acknowledge in front of these witnesses that our relationship has to change for the good of everyone. Now, I hope that you're bothered a little bit by the idea that Laban's like, hey, all those women and children belong to me, and all this belongs to me, and you're noticing that the women and the children don't have a lot of say in what's going on. You're right. Good observation. We're actually talking about that next week, okay, how women and children are treated in the Bible, right? So I just wanted to acknowledge, yes, that's also very problematic and part of the culture, sort of like incest, that we're like, that's not okay. Right? Okay, it's not okay. We're going to talk more about that next week. What I want to focus on today instead is that dissolution of the family bond there. That was for the good of both of them. That's not a way we usually think of family, as though what God is doing here somehow overshadows that. But what we see throughout the stories of the patriarchs is that family is at least as often hurtful to what God is doing in the world as it is helpful. It's really a mixed, kind of a mixed blessing. And so what I do want to pause here, because I think that's really heavy, and I want us to sit with this encounter that we've experienced between Jacob and Laban as we go back into some worship. But I want us to celebrate, I don't want us to celebrate that sometimes families have to have these hard boundaries drawn and that sometimes those family bonds have to be dissolved. That's not something worthy of celebrating. It's something worthy of mourning. What I want to celebrate instead is that even in these spaces that we encounter in Scripture that we know from our own lives that are really painful, we can celebrate that God is continuing to be at work for Laban's good, especially for Jacob's good and for the good of his family. That what they're doing here is not inhibiting the work of God in the world, because God is still at work. Okay, so we have a lot more to talk about, but I want to pause there, and I want to just spend some time acknowledging God's goodness and God's faithfulness, even in the times when our families are not good and faithful. So I want to hand it back over to Sydney and the worship team. Turn with me over to Matthew 12. This is in, obviously, the Gospels and the stories about Jesus, and this is maybe the most radical example we have in the Scriptures of the New Testament, especially of its ambivalence towards what we consider, you know, biological family. And it's a story of when Jesus is teaching. It's relatively early in his public ministry. Word has gotten out about him that he is quite the teacher, that he performs miracles, and that he challenges the authorities, right? That he is not content to go about religion and business as usual, but that he is constantly speaking truth to power, challenging those in authority, both economic and religious authority. And so in this story, his family, they come to collect him. They come to get him and like bring him home and say, okay, enough of that rabble-rousing, right? And what happens is one of those moments in the scriptures that's so challenging that if you're a Bible nerd like me, you enjoy watching theologians and commentators like tie themselves in loops to explain that what's happening is not what's happening, right? Because what's happening is challenging and is radical. So let's read this story in Matthew chapter 12, beginning of verse 46, and then I want to talk through it with you. So as Jesus was speaking to the crowd, his mother and brothers stood outside asking to speak to him. And someone told Jesus, hey, your mother and brothers are standing outside and they want to speak to you. And so Jesus asked, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? And then he pointed to his disciples, to all of those who were, you know, in the room. He said, look, these are my mothers and my brothers. Anyone who does the will of my Father in heaven is my mother and my brother and my sister and my mother. Okay, so Jesus publicly disowns his family. Right? Someone come, they say, hey, your family is outside. And he says, who? My family? My family's right here. I don't know who those people are. Allow yourself to be shocked by that, right? This is, I mean, and again, imagine, however anxious or shocked you feel, multiply that by a factor of a lot, and that's how it would have felt to the ancient world, where family was even more sort of basic to the fabric of society than it is for us today. Jesus' words were shocking. What he does here is he reorganizes the concept of family, not around biology, but around faith. Right? He says, whoever does the will of my Father, that's the one that is my family. Right? Whoever is a part of this mission that I'm on, whoever is about this good news that I'm preaching, that's the one who is my sister and my brother and my mother. Now, take a moment to imagine how Jesus' mother and siblings would have felt at this news. Right? Probably hurt, probably surprised, probably really sad. A lot of that might have even been masked in anger. And yet, Jesus knows that they have the wrong picture of him because they're not looking at him as God's Messiah come to inaugurate a new reality. They're looking at him as like, you know, I don't know, baby Jesus that they remember changing his diaper and, you know, feeding him and, you know, comforting him when he scraped his knee and all that kind of stuff. And he was that, but he's the Messiah. And they need to understand that who he is has changed their relationship with him, and they don't see that right now. So he draws this hard boundary with them. And again, I think that feels, at least for me, it feels really wrong, right? It feels wrong to say that the family of faith supersedes our obligations to our biological family. That's something that's so deeply ingrained in me as someone who's grown up in this American culture that it's really hard for me to even like say that. And yet this is what we see in Jesus' example. Now, of course, in the best case scenario, our biological families are part of our spiritual families, right? In the best case scenario, we don't have to make that decision between blood and faith because those people who are part of our biological families are also part of the family of faith. This does, in fact, happen for Jesus, okay? We know that Mary, his mother, is one of the people who makes it all the way to the cross with him, right? When even most of his disciples have abandoned him, his mama is still there. She's there at his burial, and she goes to see him at the tomb on resurrection morning. So we know that she figured it out. We know that his brother James figured it out, because James is actually, he becomes, after Jesus ascends to the throne of heaven, James becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church. He is the one in Acts 15 when there's this big conflict about what do we do with all these Gentiles that want to be part of the church. James is the one that renders the verdict. He's the judge. He's the one who says, all right, here's what we do. We're pretty sure it's the same guy that wrote the book of James in our canon. So Jesus' brother, James, he figures it out too. So again, best case scenario, like Jesus, our biological families are part of our family of faith. But do you notice that before Mary and James could fully embrace who Jesus is, Jesus had to draw that hard boundary? That came first because they couldn't get there. Their obligations to their biology had superseded their ability to recognize who Jesus is. And so Jesus had to, for their own sakes, draw that hard boundary. Now, I know that our families, our biological families, all look very different, right? And some of us enjoy a really good, healthy, flourishing relationship with our biological families. And so this message, you're kind of just like, yeah, whatever, it's fine. I'm fine, we're good, everything's good, right? And I'm super envious of you, because I know a lot of us don't have that same experience. For a lot of us, our families are a lot more complicated. Everything from just like almost completely toxic to a blend of it that's confusing enough that it's hard to parse out the differences. And so what I want to offer today is this good news that Jesus invites us into, that God has a call on our lives that supersedes our obligations to our biological families. In a way, we might say it like this: Jesus's good work frees us from an obligation to our families so that we can genuinely love our families. So that we can be good news to them in a way that it's hard to do when we have that, you know, family first kind of mentality. God's desire is for all of us, every member of every family, to find love and flourishing and peace together. But in order for that to happen, sometimes we have to draw some hard boundaries, like Jacob and Laban did, like Jesus did. If Jesus had to do that in his own biological family, we should not expect that it is going to be any easier for some of us. I know that that's the case for many of us. So what I want to do as we move into this time of response and reflection is give you some space to reflect on your familial connections, both your spiritual family here at Catalyst and your biological families, however complex and complicated those connections are. And I want to just invite you to bring all of that before God and to reflect with God on what your picture of family looks like now and how God might be calling you to change that. How God might be inviting you to be freed of obligation so that you can love without any sort of strings attached. We're going to do a prayer of examine before we approach the communion table. I'm going to give you some questions and some space to reflect. And then we're going to come to the communion table, which again echoes that table that Laban and Jacob shared. But of course, at this table, rather than dissolving a family, Jesus is creating a new family, a family that is bound by his work for us, so that we can come together as a spiritual family that becomes good news for all of our biological families and for all of the families in our community. I'm going to ask those questions, give you some space to prayerfully reflect on them, and I'll pray for all of us together, then we'll receive communion together. So here's the first question I want you to consider. Where is my biological family a source of healing and flourishing for me? Now, where does my biological family run counter to God's call on my life? Now, what does my commitment to my spiritual family look like? And finally, how is God calling me to commit to my spiritual family during Lent? Pray together. God, you have gathered us into this space that we might hear this news that you tell us is good, but I think can really challenge us, that you want to free us of our obligations to biological family. No matter how good or bad those obligations are, you call us to something deeper, a spiritual family that is organized not around genetics, but around faith, around our common rebirth into your kingdom. We admit and confess that this can be challenging, confusing, difficult for us. And yet we have seen this morning that even your son Jesus engaged in these conflicts, drew these boundaries for the sake of the good work that you've called him to. And so we now approach your communion table and we bring with us all of our confusions and our anxieties and our fears. And we leave those at your feet and we receive these elements. We pray in these moments that they would become a spiritual food for us, that as we receive them, you might open our eyes and open our ears, that we might see and hear your good news afresh, that you might bind us into a spiritual family that is able to love our biological families the same way you have loved us, that transforms us, that changes us all, that makes us all your children. We offer these prayers now when we approach your table today in the name of your son, Jesus. The night that Jesus was betrayed, he shared a meal with his disciples, and at that meal, he broke bread. He gave it to them, and he said, "This is my body broken for you. Take it and eat it." When the meal was finished, he gave them a cup of wine, and he said, "This is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of sins. Take it and drink it." And so now we too eat and drink, and as we do, we remember Jesus' death until he returns. Catalyst, as you're going today, know that you're going as a spiritual family that God has brought together, not by blood, but by our common faith in his son Jesus and in his ability to raise him from the dead. Know that that common family bond enables us to be good news to everyone in our lives, including our families, both when our families are healthy and when they're not so healthy. So would you go now into a world of families that need the love of this faith family? Would you go knowing that God has gone before you and is coming beside you and is coming along behind you to enable you to do all that you can imagine and more? Go in the grace and peace of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and we will see you next week.